Much has been written about towns like Williston, North Dakota, that boomed during the fracking explosion 15 years ago. But those stories pale in comparison to what was happening in Borger, Texas in 1927. Author Joe Pappalardo tells the story of a truly wild Western town in his new book, Boomtown. We're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Joe, and thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you so much.
Joe, what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take you to do the research?
This came out of me very, very quickly. I probably pitched it to getting accepted to actually finishing it within a year, which is pretty fast.
Yes.
And part of that is only because there was so much butt time involved in this. There was reading every single newspaper for 3 years, you know, not just the Borger Daily Herald, but every county newspaper and a bunch of state ones as well. So just the amount, the volume, and then the genealogy, and then hunting down, you know, some rare books and going to libraries and finding those. But compared to other books where you get a lot of almost like psychic resonance from being in a place, like I wrote a book set in East Texas. I mean, it's its own universe and you can still feel it, and there's family members. And this one, the Borger I describe is well and truly gone. You know, there's nothing left of it. The town is still there. It's a quaint little town, but the raucous, out of control boom town, that was a brief and glorious, if you like that kind of story, sequence of events. It happened in a very unique time in history.
Now, and I have to believe that the Borger Daily News, or whatever the name of the paper was, is not digitized such that you could sit somewhere else and do this. Where do you find these?
These days, what would take a previous generation researcher months, if not longer, to do, I can do from the comfort of my home. There's newspapers.com, which is one, and then there's something called the Portal to Texas History. Mm-hmm. And they have everyone digitized.
Wow.
For the entire span that I needed. So it was right there for me. So every day I'd walk the dogs, get a big cup of coffee, sit down and read and be surprised and recognize the characters. And I had my big, you know, whiteboard behind me, the crazy person connections and names and dates, and trying to create the narrative arc from this mess of data. And that's where it came from. And I thought, oh, I'll cover a couple of years of this town's existence. And really it was 6 to 7 months. It was all the action I could almost handle. It was a really fun experience. They're not usually this fun. This is my sixth book. They're not always this fun.
You know, the book is unique in that I felt like I was reading the daily news of the Borger paper, and the way you've laid it out, right? You know, the book is laid out where you have different dates of different events that happen in a very sort of linear chronological fashion. Have you ever done anything like that before?
No. And it was amazing how slow I could make the narrative, how I could really get the aperture instead of broadening it. I mean, there's this tendency to go for the big H history and to make sure that your story fits in and everybody knows, you know, that this is a parable about, you know, greed or oil or, you know, industrialization or whatever you want to make it. It's a story. And the slower you can tell a story and the more in depth you can make it, you know, this is maybe one page in a Frank Hamer biography, a good Hamer biography, and it's my entire book. And he deserves that level of scrutiny because he's fascinating, but so did the town and so did the events. So the ability to slow it down to a day-by-day chronological, this is what it was like to live there, not just for the cops and the robbers, but the politicians and the bakers and the bankers and the dance hall girls and everybody else, and try to make a living organism out of this town, was a unique opportunity. No, I've always wanted to, since I read Salem's Lot when I was, you know, 8 years old. I wanted to make a town, you know, make a town come alive. Stephen King did that and killed it. But at the same time, I always had that influence. And I was able to do that. And Borger really gave me that opportunity because it was so interesting, dramatic and violent and so much change. It really kept delivering for me.
Nice. So you've written about Texas Rangers before in Red Sky Morning. So was Boomtown a natural continuation of that obsession, or did Borger find you rather than the other way around?
I definitely got into it via the Ranger intervention. That was definitely my way in. I want to do something with Frank Hamer because he is the logical extension from the great Rangers that I wrote about in Red Sky. In fact, he was recruited by Rogers, who was one of the great Rangers that pops up in, not just in Red Sky Morning, but he also pops up in my Roy Bean book, Four Against the West. So the Rangers are never too far from my mind. They're just so inherently dramatic, and they get dropped into situations that are inherently, you know, have tension, narrative and dramatic tension, let's just say. And the violence is never too far away. It's always a tool in their toolkit. So they're a fascinating bunch. And the way that they develop and evolve over time and the way they keep certain traditions was certainly part of my impetus for wanting to cover this era of Texas Ranger history. And no, I didn't expect to do a Boomtown cleanup. I thought, bank robbers. I thought something where Hamer's investigative skills maybe were more into the fore. But I got seduced by this town. I mean, it's just, you know, every minor character had another weird thing they were involved in, or, you know, a turn or a decision point, or, and it was just, it drew me in, the allure of it. And I hope that's what the readers get as well. I mean, this isn't, I love books about Gettysburg and Custer's Last Stand and everything. This is a different kind of history. This is a small town that went through some very dramatic things. And to me, it's just as pertinent, just as relevant, maybe even more approachable for people to who are experiencing their own sort of personal histories.
Okay, so let's set it up a little bit in terms of, you know, Borger, the town. First of all, who was Ace Borger and how did he come to found the town?
Yeah, the one thing that I get asked a lot about is, you know, why was it the wickedest? You know, what, and whenever I see a superlative, I start trying to counter it. You know, what is that, is that just hype? And it turns out it wasn't just hype. I mean, most boom towns, there's oil discovered, there's a lot of workers, so there's service industries of various kinds that sprang up. And that's sort of the normal evolution. Things get out of control, and then they tamp back. But Borger was born to be bad, man. Like, it really, by design, was supposed to be out of control. It was supposed to be an open town. And how do I know this? One is Ace. Ace of Borger, everyone calls him Ace because he always has one up his sleeve. That was the line. He operated a boom town in Oklahoma called Cromwell. And Cromwell was an open town, completely ignored prohibition, prostitutes everywhere, gambling, the whole nine yards. It was the bad boy town in Oklahoma. And he basically got chased out of there. And the place he went was Borger. He had a family member that tipped him off to an oil discovery, so he had got the jump on the land. And as a great land speculator and town founder, he knew this was going to be a good opportunity. So not only he, but his corrupt law enforcement infrastructure all migrate down to Borger. So they're going to set up everything they had in Oklahoma and do it all over again. And my favorite newspaper article I found was contained an exchange between a county judge in Oklahoma and a prostitute named Ruby. And Ruby thought that the judge was shaking her down. Hey, this is an open city. I thought this was, you know, do you just want to be paid off or are you legit? Do I have to leave? And the judge says, you have to leave town. And she says, well, then I'm going to Borger. Even the prostitutes knew. Like, everyone was going to migrate to this open city that this guy was going to establish. It was born to be crooked, and the cops were there to be crooked. And they learned from their previous mistake, and they became entrenched in the political class. So the mayor is one of the town, was Ace's lawyer. So it was all very incestuous. It was all crafted to be corrupt. And that's one of the reasons it was so hard to clean up and why it was easy to clean out the street level crime, but getting the political crime and keeping it clean proved to be very difficult for the Rangers.
Okay, so Borger basically is tipped off about this oil thing. I take it he buys a significant amount of acreage and starts whacking it into lots to create this town. Is that how it works? And how's he going to make his money?
Yeah, the template is lay out the town, grid it out, buy the land, make a grid, and sell plots. Everything else will follow. So, and keep the choice bits of land for yourself, like City Hall. Make sure your cronies have the hospital. That's one of the scandals I wasn't expecting. So you have all of this civilization building happening very, very quickly and without a lot of planning. There was a lot more planning given to the, you know, bootlegging profits and who was going to run the liquor business and the gambling business and who's going to enforce the rules that, you know, the kickback rules. That was given a lot more attention than sewage or, you know, even the water supply. So, and mind you, in 90 days, this town grew from zero people to between 30 to 45,000 people in 90 days.
90 days.
So that is an astounding level of growth for anywhere in the world. And they were not, they sold it, they built it, you know, and interspersed with all these homes and speakeasies and service industries and shops and stores are oil rigs and dynamite, you know, storage facilities, things that explode. So this entire environment seems out of control, and it was. And that's before people would pour in at nighttime as well. The streets were thick with cars. It really was a place that was geared towards making all that illicit money. But at the same time, with 45,000 people showing up, there's a daytime aspiration as well. People who, you know, just want a second chance or a first chance. That tension between the daytime and nighttime border became more and more pronounced. Some people, like the mayor, had a foot in both worlds. Some of them, the bootleggers outside of town, they had their foot only in one world. And then some people were legitimate business owners and they wanted it cleaned up. And so that tension would really surprise me. I only thought of it as bad, but all the kind of good, and I don't really say good and bad. Everyone has their motivations and they're all sort of similar. They're all striving for something no matter what, but the illicit and legit powers in town were in, you know, inherent conflict. So it was interesting to see that those characters come out of the cops and robbers and the murders and the scandals and things. There were some real people who were there, and it was fun to cover their aspirations and their stories as well.
So you mentioned that people would drive in for nighttime. How far away would they drive in from? You know, what towns or cities?
Oh, as the reputation grew, they would come in from Oklahoma. You know, this was the place to go to have a great time. And, it's hard to capture that side of it, right? Well, was this some sort of public good, you know, or public service being provided during Prohibition? Wildly unpopular, right? Mm-hmm. This is not the only place that ignored Prohibition. As I looked into it and compared it to other boom towns and other experiences, it was inordinately violent. And one of the reasons why was the county cops in particular, and the city cops also, they would accept money from bank robbers. So this was an early era of bank robbers. So they would pay for protection, hang out in the county. And can you imagine a better place for a bank robber than these boomtown cities, you know, Borger and some of the satellites, Electric cities, some of these other smaller boomtowns that sprung up in the same county? Those were perfect for a gangster. That was apparent. You have all the gambling, all the women that you can, and all the booze and the protection. You could do it in relaxed. Now, of course, they started shooting law enforcement officers and things like that. So the bank robbers, that really sort of bit everyone. That was the thing that tipped off the state government and said, we have to do something, was the murders that were being attributed to bank robbers who were seeking sanctuary.
If this were a 1940s Warner Brothers movie, you would have this community and you would have a Gary Cooper-like figure arise from the populace to be the force of good. And as I read this thing, I didn't see anything like that. I didn't see that there was any kind of local pushback on this madness.
The local pushback, it was just the status quo. I mean, if you were there, that's what you come to expect. Yeah. You know, you knew you're going to a snake den. Don't be too surprised if you get bit. It was the killings that you know. There's this idea that Dan Moody was the governor. He's a law and order guy. He just comes into office, and he's trying to clean up from the Fergusons. And he runs as a literally law and order guy. I'm going to reestablish control. So Borger is a blight, you know, it's in direct defiance to everything that he stands for, basically, but he's still content to ignore it until the bodies start dropping, the bodies of police officers start dropping. Now he can't ignore it anymore, and now he has to send in Hamer. The idea that there's this, you know, that a white hat comes in to clean up the town, you know, is not the reality, you know, and in Borger especially, you can be welcomed one week and the next week that, you know, everyone in town is basically agreeing you should leave. That's going to happen. You know, Gary Cooper rides off at the end of the movie, not really, yes, it's dramatic, but he's doing himself and the town a favor.
Yeah.
You know, that's why Shane leaves. Like, mm-hmm. you don't stick around because when the attack dog doesn't need to attack anymore, he wears out his welcome. I mean, that's the reality. And the Rangers were always coming and going. So when you have a, you know, you compare some of their deployments in the 1800s and they're so overworked and they're, you know, they don't have the time to settle in one spot. So they have to maximize their advantages, you know, and do high impact things, shooting people or arresting people or setting up a gun shooting competition outside of town, something to establish, you know, that they're just not a dozen guys that are, you know, they're the toughest guys around. It's all psychological. In Borger, they get through that part where they can basically clean up the street, but how do you clean up the politics?
Right, right.
How do you spend month after month there without wearing out your welcome, without people saying, I want a drink, without people saying, you know, when do the dime or dance places open? They're not even prostitutes. Can I get back in there? You know, that starts happening. And when that starts happening, you lose the people. That's when the shooting incidents with the local law enforcement happen. That's when the problems with the newspaper happen, which is another big scandal for Moody, cost Rangers their careers. You know, that's when all these problems start, was when the mission creep occurs, when they're just there too long.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting part of the story, which is the street cleanup versus the political cleanup and how hard it is to do that part of it, which if you want to infer any kind of modern day lesson, you can. I don't in the book, but, you know, it seems like that's one thing that always repeats, is that occupations seem to drag on and your allies on the ground become your opponents. And it leads you to make some you trust people you probably shouldn't.
So now, let's say I was a shop owner in Borger back then. You know, we had speakeasies, gaming rooms, boxing, wrestling, brothels, everything for the oil field workers. But if I had a shop, could I have a family and kids? Was there a school?
Yeah, you could. And plenty of people did. The school, that was one, Elizabeth Borger was very, Ace's wife, was very much into building a school in the town. And what's interesting is not just that she had this impulse, but that they lived there. This had that sense of permanence for the Borger family and for a lot of the Borgerites as well. This wasn't a flash in the pan. This is supposed to be Pittsburgh, you know, a major city in a few years. Part of that permanency was a school, and they also built the first brick home there. And it was like the social nexus of the entire city while they were alive. So they had these aspirations to make it a nice place to live, but it just wasn't, you know. And he had the same aspiration at nighttime, just go full, you know, to be the premier nightlife, destination the entire, you know, not just in the county, but in all of Northern Texas. So, you know, he had both aspirations and he tried to go after them at the same time. And that balance was off in Borger from inception. It all goes back to him and his mentality towards what a town should be and what he should get out of it. He wanted all of it.
Now, could the shop owner run for political office, or was the entire political machine corrupt?
You could. It didn't seem to be a good idea unless the Rangers were there to supervise the election. The question is, why would you? If you're throwing your hat in that arena, it's inherently risky. You're going to run up against the criminal element and you're going to run up against the Rangers. So that's a lot of heat. And it seems like maybe this is just something you would say about politicians in general, but the people that were willing to do it were kind of the last people you'd want to do it. They were, you know, casting around looking for a replacement for the mayor. The people the Rangers and the state wanted all said no. You know, they had other better things to do with their time in Borger than to be involved in that. And the people they trusted turned out to have ulterior motives that were not the purists. It's hard to find a good guy, but when you're really desperately looking for one because you want to get the hell out of town, again, you might trust the wrong people. And that's the political part of the story that is just as nasty as some of the revenge killings and and some of the bootlegging scams, you know.
So let's talk some more about Hammer. I mean, you know, when I read his name, I visualize Kevin Costner in The Highwayman, who played Hammer, you know, in a movie that sort of, you know, enhanced his image. And I know he goes on to sort of lead the posse that kills Bonnie and Clyde sometime later in his career. Let's talk a little bit about him. And is he the guy who comes in with the white hat to clean up the town?
I mean, narratively, yes. That is exactly his job. And that is exactly his function in the book. I definitely wanted, like I said before, to do something with the sort of later year Hammer, but before Bonnie and Clyde, while he was still an active Ranger. That was sort of my, you know, my original impulse for this book, because I wanted to know what kind of investigator he was. Mm-hmm. I wanted to look into some of his cases. I wanted to look into, you know, he would track bomb makers, and he had tracked, you know, multiple murders and bank robbers. And he had, you know, I wanted to see some of his tradecraft. He did not like to share his tradecraft, and most of what he does is trapped behind grand jury. You know, You're never going to get it. It's sealed for forever. So a lot of his methodology is word of mouth or results-oriented or tracing newspapers or tracing court records. It's tough with him. But Borger was good. It tied him down for a little while. And it was interesting to see how he reacted to the cleanup of that town and how much he was able to get done in a short amount of time and how his replacement dealt with it. He was a senior captain. He was in Austin. So he was deployed wherever the hot spot was. He couldn't stay in Borger forever and he didn't want to. So another captain, Thomas Hickman, another very famous captain, steps in and he's got a much gentler touch and things don't really go as well under him, in my opinion, mm-hmm. as it did under Hammer. So It was interesting because he's either known as the trigger man, the guy who always goes for the gun, or his, you know, 45 people that he killed over his career and everything. And that's all there. And violence is always part of his toolkit and all of his authority. A lot of it comes from, is he going to pull that gun to hit you with the gun butt or is he going to shoot you with it? He's not shy about that part. Don't get me wrong. But he's also pretty clever. And I didn't expect to have a political corruption case that he was involved in Austin that happened concurrent with the book. He was involved in a lot of different things, and it was fun to explore those different facets of the Hammer biography, which again, take a page or two in most big, good biographies of him and slow it down to what actually happened with the case. And when you see how he hits up against the Texas legal system, you start thinking, yeah, he knows how much easier it is just to shoot people and bring justice that way than it is to try and bring him into a courtroom. That is an obstacle that he can't bully his way through. And I've looked into a lot of his cases now for a possible follow-up, and it's very true. It's a frustration for him that he hits up against. And sometimes he achieves his goal not by going through the justice system. Not extrajudicial killings, but media attention or just applying pressure. Sometimes maybe threatening or something worse, you know, that he used every diplomatic and law enforcement and investigative tool to get whatever that job needed to get done for the governor. Those are the tools he would bring. So he's a multifaceted kind of guy. It's very interesting to see him a little bit later in life, you know, and not relying so much on the gun as much as maybe his brains.
Joe, you confess up front to imagining conversations that there's no historical record of. And you explain your creative process in the footnotes. Where do you draw the line between narrative reconstruction and fiction? And was that a line you ever worried? Did you worry about crossing that line when you were writing the book?
This one, no. If I was putting those words in somebody's mouth, I was pretty damn sure I knew where they were coming from and where they were going, mm-hmm. right? I mean, there's a lot of historical documentation on everything in the book. If I didn't know someone was a White Sox fan, I didn't say they're a White Sox fan. I didn't color outside the lines too much. But I come up through journalism, and a quote is sort of sacrosanct. And if I'm putting something in a quote, I'm going to mea culpa and just say, I don't know that these two had this conversation in this meeting, but the net result of this meeting was they forced out the mayor. This guy happened. These people were definitely at this meeting. They talked about something. This is a great anecdote. I'm going to put it in there, you know, and footnote, 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 so that readers are never thinking I'm just out there freelancing. saying, you know, oh, you know, no invented characters, no amalgamated characters. Everyone was there and talking to each other. If that's not what they said, it was the import of what, if it was a traditional history book, I would have to pause and say, here's how we know this and that, and he did this later, and we know, and you're so busy explaining how you know that you lose the thread of the story. So I sort of chose another direction, or it chose me. I tried it both ways, and it was very clunky, and it didn't work, and I couldn't make as much connective. The connective tissue was not as strong without the dialogue. And again, when you slow things down and you have interactions between people, that's where the inventiveness would come in. Well, that's also where the newspaper reporters are, and the anecdotes and the personal remembrances and letters and all the other sort of, you know, the genealogy. You know, if I know the piano player was diving away from bullets, that's because he told his, you know, grandniece that, and they recorded it, and it was there for me to be found. So the amount of details that I was able to find, I leaned into those. And if I didn't know something, I would lean away from it. I mean, to be totally frank, with as many characters there are in this book, it was easy to sort of weave and lean into the things I knew were well documented. Not just the occurrences, but the attitudes. And not just the attitude of a person, but how it changed over time. So I would try to, you know, not have an anachronistic viewpoint, you know, coming out of someone's mouth if I could help it. So again, immersing yourself in the newspapers of the day really helps, you know, find the voice and sketch out all these characters. But making them interact was fun, but I tried to keep it. I wasn't trying to write a screenplay. You know what I mean? Yeah. I wasn't trying to make it as clever as possible. If I thought something was funny, I would cut it out. Because I don't think Hamer would think that was funny. I knew what his sense of humor was like, and it's not mine. So I didn't try to plant that, you know, Quentin Tarantino kind of every hitman has to have a patter. I tried to keep it, you know, true to the people of the time, and not put my stamp on anything.
Before we go, I wanted to go back into a question that I had. One of the things I liked about the book is there were a number of other interesting characters that you profile. Many of these were people who were like trying to seek a second chance at success. People like, we had this dance hall maven, Maddie Castleberry, and the wrestler, Dutch Betke, who I really liked. How important was it to show a story that included these kinds of people who were aspiring to be successful?
It was not my intention when I started out, to be totally honest. I looked at a tapestry of, you know, cops and robbers and, you know, small town heat, you know, here comes the, you know, it was a bipolar town. It had two sides, and I discounted the striving, legit side until I started teasing out some of these characters and seeing them recurring really in the newspapers, and seeing that, you know, there was a big profile in an Amarillo newspaper about the baker in town who was a bankrupt banker. And I thought, well, that's interesting. He got back on his feet and he's making a lot of money selling bread. And then, you know, by the end of me reading through his saga, he's back into banking and he's the president of a bank in Borger. So, you know, I would be a fool not to see these arcs that resolve themselves right in front of me in the newspapers. They went up on my whiteboard and I didn't know what to do with them. And then you see his name is one of the people that the Rangers really liked for mayor, and he said no. So now he's weaved, you know, this universe, you know, these characters bump into each other. And you know, I was following Dutch Betke really because I was looking at the newspaper and the fact that the political columnist and cartoonist was also the sports columnist, and he loved covering wrestling. So I really got into his accounts of wrestling. I saw, you know, Dutch Betke, the eight man of the panhandle. And then I started seeing the ads for him, and I started looking into his history and his sort of narrative arc and his striving to stay on top in the entertainment world of Borger. Just really, I didn't see that coming, and I wouldn't have thought to even pitch it to begin with, but there he was. And it kept happening, and it wasn't just the bad guys, and it wasn't just the, you know, the bootleggers, even though they were fascinating, the corrupt cops were even better. And the Rangers, you know, aside from Hamer, you know, the ones and the trouble they got into when their backgrounds turned out to be, everyone just kept giving and giving and giving. So these, you know, ancillary characters became larger characters and stand-ins of a sort for that daytime, you know, it's Borger during the day and Boogertown at night. And those are the, you know, that's the Borger side. I had a lot of Boogertown people to start with, but the, you know, the actual legit, you know, second, you know, looking for that, looking to rebuild their lives, just, you know, that was a surprise to me and a very pleasant one.
So, Joe, what do you want, what do you most want a reader to take away from the Borger story? You know, a place that no one, most people have never heard of.
Yeah, I, you know, the longer I think about it, now that it's sort of out and in the world and people are reacting to it, I think that's shaping that my response a little bit. Because I like what people are saying to me, which is, it doesn't have to be Gettysburg and it doesn't have to be Pearl Harbor. It can be a small town. It's all history. It's your history. And if I want anyone to get anything from it besides just a good story, and if there's any lessons to be learned, it's only because history repeats itself and you're going to see reflections in everything. But I would say, look at how important genealogy is. You know, look how important it is to record family history. You look at where your family history fits into the larger tapestry. It doesn't have to be capital H history. You don't have to witness something like that for it to be important. And a town like Borger is just as important as St. Louis in terms of what it means for the development of the country, and especially in Texas. But, you know, this is not the only boom town that's ever going to happen. And what it means to build something up from nothing and you know, what choices you make along the way. That is timeless, but it only comes alive because someone recorded all the histories. And it's not just the newspapers and the big books. It's, you know, journals, it's oral histories. It's just preserving what you got and making sure it's there for someone like me to find in 100 years. The story's 100 years old and people are reacting as, you know, as if it's very relevant, which makes me so happy. And all I can do is thank the people who recorded those family histories and made sure that there was a legacy. So if there's a message I don't say in the book at all, it's that. But that's a takeaway I hope people get, that their towns are important too. So, you know, treat the histories with as if they are.
Okay, the book is Boomtown, the true story of the wickedest town in Texas. We've been having a chat with the author, Joe Pappalardo. Joe, thanks so much for spending so much time with us today.
Oh, thank you. I could go on and on. You guys are great.
We'll be right back after this.